We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. Now here's your program.
Welcome to Sidetrack, AM580's monthly features magazine. I'm your host, Jason Croft. This month, we talk to the man behind the site, Jim's Pancakes, a blog that chronicles one man's quest to make cool pancakes for his daughter. We find out about the upcoming annual Superman celebration in Metropolis, Illinois, and we hear from comedy duo Rhett and Link, who make a living creating online commercials and songs. We'll have those stories and more, this time, on Sidetrack. Pancakes, in and of themselves, are not very interesting to look at. They're pretty much beige circles. But one man is making pancakes into art. His name is Jim Belosik, and he is the man behind the popular blog Jim's Pancakes. It all started simply enough as a father making breakfast for his daughter. Now it's an internet sensation. I talked with Belosik recently and asked him first where he gets his ideas from.
I don't really know. Most of them, I guess, I get from my daughter. I'll ask her, what kind of pancake do you want? And she'll just throw out some kind of crazy idea. So I guess she's the main source. Some of it does come from the blog. People request certain things. And some of them I come up with on my own because I'm trying to think of something that would be a challenge. So, and anything that I can come up with where I think my daughter will eat it and she'll have a good giggle out of it, that's a good design for me.
So this all started with making breakfast for your daughter. And how old is she?
She's three.
She's 3 years old. And so is it every Saturday you make pancakes for her?
Every single Saturday.
And so what was the point where the ordinary pancake just wasn't enough for her?
I think from day one, I always wanted to make sure that I gave her something that would put a smile on her face. So I think, you know, we started out, I tried to make a poodle. I think that's one of my first blog posts, and it looks pretty darn horrible. But she got a real big kick out of it, and I thought, wow, if she likes the ugly, horrible poodle that I burned, she'll like her pancakes even better if I actually do a good job.
Why and when did you get the idea to start blogging?
I run a couple other blogs. I do web design as a living, so it was kind of natural for me to, as a way to document everything. And I thought since Allie was getting such a kick out of it, it would be a cool way to, you know, have a good running record of everything that we were doing so that we could look at it in, you know, 5 years or 10 years and say, oh, remember how funny that was.
So what does she think about all this and the attention that your blog is getting?
She doesn't really understand the attention. You know, I don't really talk to her about it that much. She does know that, you know, she says, why do we have the camera going? And I tell her, well, that's so all the people can see what we're doing. And she thinks that's pretty special. But I don't think she really understands that, how many people are actually paying attention to the pancakes.
So tell us a little bit about your technique about making pancakes. Because it seems... And because some of your designs, your more recent designs, I got to tell you, are pretty intricate.
Yeah, I've refined the technique through trial and error.
And I'm sure there were a lot of errors, weren't there?
There are, although not as many as you would think. Pancake is actually a pretty forgiving material. you just have to work really quick, and I've gotten a lot of burns from the griddle. So the best thing is, you know, using those squeeze bottles gives you a lot of control, and, you know, anything you can draw on a piece of paper, you can pretty much draw on the griddle.
And you're using different colored pancake batter as well.
Correct. I've been experimenting with different food colorings, but I really don't like to use a lot of food coloring, just because I'm not sure if it's the most healthy thing in the world. So I've been trying to experiment with some fruit juices and different natural food colorings. But if you're going to make a princess pancake, you got to make sure that she has a pink dress. So, you can use a little, strawberry preserves, or somebody actually suggested beet juice, and I'm going to be trying that this weekend to see if that works for a good red dye.
What sort of feedback have you been getting from people about the blog and about the particular pancakes you make?
A ton of positive feedback. The thing that I love the most is the people saying, oh my gosh, I remember my dad making me fun Mickey Mouse pancakes or whatever. And people say, she's going to remember it forever. And, it's really nice to hear that feedback, because that's why I'm doing it. It's not so much about the pancakes. It's about, making time and, getting her involved and having a good laugh and hopefully making some good memories.
Well, I got to tell you, most of your pancakes are very pretty, lots of color, but there was one you did recently that just blew my mind, and that would be the Ferris wheel pancake, because it's not just a flat pancake, it's 3D.
Yeah, that one was a bit of a challenge. Someone suggested that on my Facebook page, and I thought, that's a great idea. I wonder if I can do it. So it was more of a challenge to actually see if it was possible, and it was. It took me about an hour, so it was about the longest pancake to make, but it worked out pretty successful, and Allie got a pretty big kick out of it, because we take her to we have a Ferris wheel locally. She's been on it a few times, so she knew what it was, and she was pretty excited.
Of the pancakes you've done so far, and you haven't been doing this very long, since the beginning of the year, right?
Yeah, really got active in it kind of this last 60 days, probably.
So, of the pancakes you've done so far, which one or which ones have been your favorite?
I would probably say the cheeseburger was pretty fun. I was surprised at how good it looked at the end, and Allie got a really big kick out of it. She actually ate it like a cheeseburger, so it was pretty fun, watching her. I guess one of my other favorites is one of my first ones that I did. It was a snake. And I was shocked at how easy it was. So it's something that everyone could do at home. And it was just a coiled-up snake pancake and a couple chocolate chip eyes, and I thought that guy was pretty cool.
So what would you tell people who are trying to do this themselves at home? What sort of pointers would you give to them?
I guess the first thing is to buy a couple ketchup squeeze bottles and put your batter in there. Make sure that the batter is going to be the right consistency. It needs to be a little thinner than you normally make it. You also want to make sure that there's no clumps in the batter, so you're going to mix it a little more than you would a regular pancake. The other thing is just, make sure that you get the kids involved and, let them mix the batter and let them take a shot at it. They have a really good time. And the coolest thing is that when you serve them a pancake in a neat shape, they don't even want to put syrup on it or anything. So I think it's actually healthy, too.
So what's next for you? What sort of pancake designs are you working on right now?
Actually, just this morning, I made a biplane. And so that's going to go up on the blog. I'm going to work on a couple national monuments. And then I think some Star Wars pancakes are in order.
Wow. So have you got any offers from pancake mix makers, somebody who wants endorsements?
No, I haven't, but I think it would be fun. I've gotten a lot of interesting, emails from different people that say, oh, you need to be on this show or you need to partner with these guys. But, right now I'm doing it for fun. If there was an opportunity, it would be really exciting, but nothing concrete yet.
And so where do you go from here?
I keep doing it until Allie gets bored of it, I guess. But right now I think it's pretty fun. And, every single day of the week she asks me, she doesn't quite know her days of the week yet. So she says, what day is it? I say, well, it's Wednesday. She'll say, oh, so pancakes tomorrow? And I said, no, you got to wait till Saturday. So she's still looking forward to it. So we'll keep doing it for a long time here, I hope.
Well, great. And if people want to check out the pancakes for themselves, where should they go?
It's just jimspancakes.com. Or they can find me on Facebook, and that's facebook.com/jimspancakes.
That was Jim Belosik. I was talking to him about his blog, Jim's Pancakes. He and his daughter, Allie, live in Reno, Nevada. You're tuned to Sidetrack. A comedy duo from North Carolina known as Rhett and Link have gone from being grade school class clowns to stars of the World Wide Web. These self-proclaimed internet tainers have generated more than 200 web-based videos. While they create songs and accompanying videos on anything, Rhett McLaughlin and Link Neal have learned to make a living recently by creating internet commercials for large corporations like Taco Bell, Sanyo, and Alka-Seltzer. They've also written and produced a series of free ads for local businesses through a collaboration with the MicroBuilt Corporation. Jeff Bosser talked with Rhett McLaughlin and Link Neal about finding their niche.
You were caught writing profanity on your desk in first grade, and that's how you met. But obviously it took a lot longer to figure out that Your mischief was more than a hobby. You had creative juices that flowed together. How did this progress as you grew up together and then went away to college together?
We really honed our skills of, you know, I guess being a comedy duo with every opportunity to engage an audience. You know, so like in high school, there were, we had elections for class positions. What are they called? You know, when you're like president, vice president?
Class officers.
And it's like,
that's why you didn't get elected, Link.
Because I called it a class position.
Yeah.
So there were elections for class officers, and we both ran for different offices just to give the political speech.
We just wanted to get up in front of the entire school and deliver a speech. And I remember we went to the Beta Club convention, you know, like the academic club convention, and we convinced our friend in middle school, Michael, to run for office, or actually run for like regional president of Beta Club, just so we could get up and somehow enter into his speech. And I remember, I don't know how this happened, but you ended up with a leaf blower and a helmet on, basically emitting a stream of air onto the entire audience. I mean, it was completely ridiculous.
I blew away the competition.
It's definitely something we don't want. We're glad there's not a video record of it. Hopefully there isn't. But yeah, any opportunity to gather an audience and then try to make them laugh, we took advantage of that.
Yeah, you guys went away to college and both thought that you had to find, you know, regular paying jobs that were completely different than what you were doing for fun on the side.
Yeah, we thought we wanted to be, we wanted to major in film, but our parents thought that it would be more sensible for us to get a real education. And so we decided to major in engineering because we were capable at math. Yeah, so we both ended up getting engineering degrees. I got an industrial engineering degree. Rhett got a civil engineering degree, which, as everyone knows, is the most strategic and direct path to being an entertainer.
Will you ever stop and think what you would have done? Maybe you would have had to have gone through that path if it hadn't been for the web, if you guys grew up like, you know, 30 years earlier.
I think that if this was the 1970s or even the 80s, first of all, we'd be dressed differently. But second of all, I don't think we'd be doing this for a living, because we always said, you know what, we're not going to do the starving artist thing. Before we made the decision to try to be in entertainment full time, we were already married, each to a wife with a couple of kids, and we had to find a way to support them. So the whole idea of moving somewhere, like moving to LA, moving to New York and trying to make it, was something that really wasn't on our radar. So the internet really provided a way for us to have an outlet, to not have to fully commit to anything, but kind of put some stuff out there and see what people thought about it. And then eventually it sort of became a business as people said, yeah, we like this and we want to see what you guys are going to do next.
So how did you first pitch this idea of web ads that, you know, you got paid to do?
typically what we do is we're approached by brands. We're approached by people who want to do something in online advertising and want to work with us in some way. So the CEO of Microbuilt was just a fan, just happened to like our videos and said, you know, called us up and said, I want to find a way to work together. And we found out that part of Microbuilt's business, well, really all of Microbuilt's business, is serving small and medium-sized businesses. So at first, we didn't really see a connection there, but then we thought, well, if everybody that they serve is a small business, maybe we can do something for these small businesses and make that work somehow with an internet video. And we've always loved local commercials. We've always loved really, really bad local commercials. We think they're an art form in and of themselves, just with the ridiculous concepts and, you know, they're so bad they become good again principle. We decided to just embrace that and actually go and make these commercials that are in the vein of local commercials, star real employees, real customers in the commercials, and this would be a service that Microbuilt was providing. And so that's how it became a sponsored series, to be able to provide free commercials for businesses all across America.
There's a cry across the heartland, a yearning for the days gone by. And in little old Corden, Indiana, they're happy and they'll tell you why. They got butt drugs, they love butt drugs. Ba-ba-ba butt drugs, ba-ba-ba butt drugs.
I love butt drugs.
I recommend butt drugs for everybody.
I can always count on butt drugs.
And I assume that the business picks up at places like Butt Drugs.
Oh, yeah. I mean, we were surprised to find that we got an email, hey, your Butt Drugs commercial is featured on Ellen. You know, it's like we weren't notified ahead of time. We just turn on Ellen, and like in the first 5 minutes of the show, she's showing the Butt Drugs commercial, and her intro is, now, I'm going to show you some commercials later on in my show, but I wanted to go ahead and show you this one, and I'm told it's real. You know, people can't believe that something so wacky is real, but we can honestly say it is real. It's a real business. Those are the real customers who are featured in the thing. Sure, we calculated it to kind of make it crazy on purpose. We got the customers to say things that maybe aren't the perfect things to say in a commercial, but yeah, I mean, it is a real commercial. And it generated a lot of buzz for Butt Drugs. All of our commercials generate a lot of local press. Everybody in town, you know, but especially because we like to pick small towns, you know, everybody knows everybody. Everybody hears about these crazy commercials that are being made because they rub shoulders with the people who are the stars of these commercials every day around town. So when it gets featured on CNN or the Jay Leno show or something like that, everybody tends to hear about it.
Corden, Indiana isn't all that far from here. I guess with such a somewhat embarrassing last name, it probably wasn't a big deal for you to show them, hey, look what we can do for you guys on the web.
No, I think what we found with Butt Drugs is just from a quick perusing of their website, you learn that they're very comfortable with the name Butt Drugs. They have embraced the butt.
Right. So for us, you know, people go on our website, they nominate their favorite local business or their own business for a free commercial, and then we, you know, we literally export the list and look down the list. And a business like Butt Drugs definitely tends to stand out. And so we called them up immediately to make sure it was real. And then once they were game and Katie Butt, the owner and manager of the pharmacy, was on board, the commercial pretty much wrote itself.
Look at the sofa. It's perfect for a black person or a white person.
This mattress is perfect for a white person or a black person.
At the Red House, where black people and white people buy furniture.
And Hispanic people, too.
And all people.
How about Red House Furniture? Because that's a little out there. Was that solely your guys' idea?
Well, kind of. The way the process works is, pick the business we go to, we give them a phone call, and they say they're cool with us coming out and making a commercial for free. That's pretty much where the planning ends until we physically arrive on location. And then we pretty much put the stipulation out there that, okay, we're gonna conceptualize, script, and shoot the video within the next 36 hours so that we can get back home and start editing this thing. So we go down to High Point, North Carolina, and we're talking to the employees at Red House Furniture, and we're like, you know, tell us about the customers that come in here. The first thing they said was, well, there's black people that buy furniture here. There's white people that buy furniture here. That's the first thing they told us. So we thought it was kind of funny. They were like, yeah, we're like the Rainbow Coalition of Furniture. They thought it was funny.
But I don't think they necessarily were suggesting that that should be the entire angle of the commercial. So we went back in the next day and we said, okay, guys, we've got it. The angle is
racial reconciliation.
It's a furniture commercial that's all about racial reconciliation. And there was a long silence. But then one of them was like, okay. And there you have it. We made the Red House commercial.
One thing you're promoting now is this movie that I believe won an award at a festival, Looking for Ms. Locklear. Was it your first grade teacher?
Right. Ms. Locklear was our first grade teacher. She's the one who held us in from recess for writing nasty words on our desks. She's the reason that we're friends to this day, and we always talk about her. So we said, we want to make a movie. We don't have any money. That means it needs to be a documentary. What can we do a documentary about? Well, we talk about Ms. Locklear all the time, but we've totally fallen out of touch with her. What if we found her, documented the entire process without the use of the phone or the internet? So only through conversations and face-to-face contact with people, that would be our process to search for Ms. Locklear. We document it, make it into a movie.
And so we went on that search in 2006, and over the past few years, in our spare time, we put that movie together, ended up releasing it last year. It won a number of awards and at film festivals, and it's been, you know, a crowd favorite at a lot of places, and it got shown on South Carolina PBS and a couple other places on TV, and now it's available for purchase at LockleerMovie.com.
We're looking for Miss Locklear, our first grade teacher.
Who is she?
Lenore Locklear. Uh-huh. You know her?
No, I didn't know her, no.
What's her first name?
Lenore. Lenore. She's a lovely Indian.
Lenore Locklear.
It seems like I ought to know this face.
Is that maybe an opportunity to show your serious side, too? I mean, we have so many funny videos and ads out there.
Yeah, I think that in contrast to web video, you know, web video, you've got a couple of minutes to make an impact, to make somebody laugh, and you really can't fit much else in there. But I think with this movie, we didn't really set out to say, hey, let's make something that's serious or something that's funny. We just said, let's make something that's interesting. And, you know, we were funny in places, but then the movie became a lot bigger when we discovered the Lumbee tribe of Native Americans in North Carolina, the largest Indian tribe east of the Mississippi River, and their struggle for federal recognition, which they're still in to this day. Really a great story, and the movie became a lot more about them than it did a couple of guys looking for their first grade teacher.
What are some future plans for you guys? I mean, I'm sure you always got new videos you're creating, not only ads, but some things like, I know you got one online now about the 80s where you borrow a whole bunch of fine artifacts from that decade, you know, jam boxes and a DeLorean and stuff like that.
Yeah, our bread and butter before these commercials came along and were so successful, was definitely our music and, you know, musical comedy and a lot of music videos. Some of our biggest videos, even to this day, are still music videos. So the plan is, as soon as we get a little bit of downtime, we've got a few more some songs we're going to write, more music videos that'll be coming out. We actually released an album last year, too, that kind of was a compilation of all the music that we're proud of in our musical careers up to this point. So it's actually called Up to This Point, 27 songs. And we're hoping to, you know, add to those songs that we're proud of and release more music videos this year.
So you can go on our website and watch the Facebook song, Our Ode to the 80s Electronics in the 80s, songs like that, other songs we're working on. We wrote a song called Photoshop Your Memories, which basically you can alter your self-image by altering pictures. We've all been there and done that.
Your high school reunion is coming next Friday, and you know everyone will ask to see some pictures of the babies that you've made. But the problem is your kid's head is big. I mean, we're talking alien size here. We'll just cut and paste a hat, or at least a do-rag, and it won't seem so severe. Photoshop your memories. Monday was a fun day, except for one thing. Your mother-in-law, who makes your skin crawl, stuck her face in every frame. You'd prefer to remember that day without her tattooed brows. The simplest solution, decrease the resolution and crop that woman out. Photoshop your
Jeff Bosser talked to the online comedy duo of Rhett McLaughlin and Link Neal, better known as Rhett and Link. Their work can be found online at rhettandlink.com and ilovelocalcommercials.com. The two are also featured prominently on YouTube. Ever wish you could pretend you were someone else? Independent producer Nate DeMeo introduces us to an average guy from Brooklyn who became a serial imposter.
Let me introduce you to Ethan Weinberg, and to Dr. Clifford Wyman, and Royal Sancerre, and Rodney Wyman, and C. Sterling Wyman. But first, let me introduce you to Stanley Clifford Wyman, 7 years old, working the front desk at the Dunwoody Motel in Yonkers, in the middle of the night on August 27th, 1960, right before the two gunmen walked in. He had been working the motel's graveyard shift for a year, which was longer than he had spent at nearly any other job he'd ever had. He liked it. He liked the hours. He liked the quiet. It gave him time to think and to remember the people he had known in his life and the people he had been. Stanley Clifford Wyman was born Stephen Jacob Weinberg in Brooklyn in 1890. His parents encouraged their boy to dream big, but they couldn't afford to send him off to the schools he'd have to attend if he wanted to achieve his particular dream, one of overseas adventure and white-tie luxury as a diplomat. So after high school, Stephen Weinberg got himself a job, assisting a portrait photographer in Lower Manhattan with an upper-crust clientele. The men who would come to the studio to sit weren't Rockefellers or Astors. They weren't the men atop the pyramids of capital and government and public works. They were the men who held the pyramids up. And as Stephen smoothed an unruly epaulette on a dress uniform, applied some powder to rein in an obstinate glare, he would listen. Listen to these attachés, vice chairs, assistants to this, special deputies for that. And through their blustering and name-dropping, Stephen not only got a window into a world of power he'd never known, he got a schematic of the world as it really worked. And he studied its titles and trappings, and mastered its body language and bon mots. And then he put his education to good use. Stephen Jacob Weinberg's 20th birthday party was attended by more than 75 of the highest, falutinous New Yorkers. They arrived in top hats and tails, in pearls and peacock feathers. They snacked on hors d'oeuvres while listening to speeches by fellow luminaries, including one justice of the New York State Supreme Court, who toasted bon voyage to the event's honoree, S. Clifford Weinberg, the United States' newly appointed consul general to Algeria. It was a night to remember, a night he liked to remember. 50 years later, at 2:30 in the morning, at the front desk of a mid-priced motel just off Route 9. And no one would have been the wiser to his elaborate charade back in 1910, except that a week later, the Supreme Court justice, who, like all the guests, had been taken by Stephen's sham invitation and rented tux, the justice had been so taken with the faux consul general's graceful manner and boyish charm that he invited him down to the courthouse for lunch. However, he also coincidentally invited Stephen's boss to take a photograph to commemorate the visit. Though the incident landed him in a psychiatric hospital for 6 months, it taught him two things. One, that if you look the part and talk the part and look people in the eye and tell them you are someone you are not, they will believe you. And two, doing that is incredibly fun. And so in 1960, tallying the nightly take in the cash box at the Dunwoody Motel, he could do an accounting of how he spent his 70 years. Of the day he told the head shrinkers at the sanatorium that he was done with imposture for good, and they recommended him for parole. Of the 2.5 years he'd spent in prison upstate for skipping out on his parole. And of all the nights during those 2.5 years, when you think about that one night on his 20th birthday, and the banquet, and the toasts, and about how every night should be like that, Stanley Clifford Wyman was the name he chose for his workaday life, the one he'd answer to while he plotted out his grander impersonations. It was the name he used in the phone book, the one reporters would ask for when they'd call him up for comment after one of his many elaborate schemes was exposed. And he would be happy to talk to them. He'd be happy to tell them about the day he declared himself the consul general from Romania, how he hired a boat, came up alongside the flagship of the United States Naval Fleet, and asked permission to come aboard, and how he spent the day touring the ship alongside an admiral who was so pleased with the foreign dignitary's visit, he honored him with a 21-gun salute. He'd be happy to tell them about the time that he'd read in the paper that the Princess of Afghanistan was in town, and how he showed up at her door and declared himself a State Department official, and then took her down to Washington and introduced her to President Harding. In 1926, a New York funeral home became the center of the world for a week as it prepared for the funeral of Rudolph Valentino, the world's biggest movie star. And Stanley Wyman was at the center of all of it, posing as Valentino's head PR man. He ran the funeral. And at the same time, he convinced the silent film star Pola Negri to hire him as her personal physician. Even when the papers noticed that the PR guy was the same guy as the personal physician, and both of them were the same guy from Brooklyn who kept scamming everybody, Pola Negri came to his defense. She said she'd never gotten better medical care. He was happy to talk to reporters about how he pulled scam after scam, year after year. Sure, he wound up in jail a lot for it, but he'd get out eventually. What was 6 months here, year and a half there? He told the papers he was an American boy, imbued with a go-get-em spirit. One man's life is boring, he said. I have lived many lives. I'm never bored. And the people who read about those lives loved it. They loved how this average guy from Brooklyn kept going out and getting them. They loved Stanley Clifford Wyman, serial pretender, at least until he was caught for teaching other people how to pretend they were crazy to avoid serving in World War II. They were less psyched about that. And when they read about him next, a decade later, on trial for taking a loan on a house that didn't exist, that seemed beneath him. He couldn't even convince the judge he was crazy. Other men were starting their retirements, and he was starting another jail term. That was 1955, 5 years before that night in August at the Dunwoody Motel, where he'd gone to work to find peace and quiet and time to think about the days behind him. And thinking back, the best nights may not have been the ones that landed him in the papers. Because there were ones like that perfect summer night when he made up yet another name and arranged a full police escort and picked up a friend from the train station. And they drove the length of the city in a borrowed Mercedes convertible without needing to stop for a single traffic light. And there was the night after that day he met a pretty young woman while walking through Prospect Park and dazzled her with his naval uniform and tales of oversea adventure. That night he turned to her and admitted that none of what he had been telling her was true, that he was just a kid from Brooklyn with no job and no money, who'd never been anywhere. Or the night a few weeks later when they were married. Or all the nights during the next 45 years when he and his wife would get dressed up, pretend to be people they were not, and eat and dance at the best joints in the city. Those are the nights that tied the whole story together, this whole crazy plot, with all these characters he'd been making up for the last 50 years, and all the adventures he'd had while pretending to be people who had adventures. Yes, one man's life is boring. He had lived many lives. He was never bored. He could tell himself that at the front desk of the Dunwoody Motel, when two burglars came in through the front door with guns drawn and yelled at this 70-year-old man to hand over the cash box and assume that a 70-year-old man is just going to hand over the cash box because that's what any 70-year-old man would do. Stanley Clifford Wyman died on August 27, 1960 when he threw the cash box down at his feet and leapt over the counter and ran straight at two men with guns who shot him and killed him as they turned tail and ran away. Which is exactly what any of the men he had ever been would have done in his shoes.
That was independent producer Nate DeMeo. You can hear his podcast, The Memory Palace, at www.thememorypalace.us. Still to come, a preview of this year's Superman celebration. And if you had a superpower, what would it be? Stay tuned. You're listening to Sidetrack. The old saying goes, see a penny, pick it up. All the day you'll have good luck. But how many of us would actually bend down to pick up a penny nowadays? Writer Andrew Hiller would go so far as to say we hate the penny. Here's more.
Americans hate money. Every day I see money scattered on the street, just left behind. And people stare at it in disdain. No one bends to pick it up. Hardly anyone even pauses anymore. They just leave it behind. At cash registers, they groan upon being forced to take it. The other day, I saw a pile of it just lying discarded by a payphone at Metro Center. We hate money. More specifically, we are opposed to the penny. You would think people would love the penny. It is the only coin worth more than its face value. It costs more than a penny to make a penny. Melt it down, and you've made a profit. Pennies keep the copper industry alive. Without the penny, everything would cost more. Yet pennies are the enemy. Maybe it's because we've wised up to the trick of things being $4.99. Subtracting that one penny is an illusion, a lie. And maybe we're all sick of it. Or maybe it's because the penny is worthless. You can't buy anything for a penny. Penny nails cost more than a penny. Penny candy? You can't buy a piece of penny candy for less than a quarter. There isn't one single item at JCPenney that costs a penny. Not one! People can't stand pennies. Seriously. What would you do if it started raining pennies? You would duck under cover and wait till it stopped. For some, it might even cause a crisis in faith. No one wants pennies from heaven anymore. I remember Christmas songs where people would be content with a halfpenny or a halfpenny. Can you even imagine that? Who would want that? Other than my father. He collects coins. Inflation has killed the penny. The only thing that still costs a penny are my thoughts. A penny for my thoughts? Are you kidding me? How insulting is that? The heart of American culture used to be innovation, invention, creativity. And yet our thoughts are the only thing not subject to inflation. We used to be told to count our pennies. We used to think a penny saved is a penny earned. Now people can hardly be bothered with quarters. Perhaps that's why so many corporations are so eager to farm out their business, to outsource. Americans love a buck, and by outsourcing, you can spend pennies on the dollar. Even the name has gone out of fashion. There is no place for pennies in today's culture, except the wishing well. They're full of them. At a fountain or well, you see people closing their eyes as they hurl a penny into the water. Do they really think fate can be bought off with a penny? Do people really bank their wishes and dreams on a penny? I know pennies are important. Each penny should be cherished. A penny represents the little thing, slow accumulation and progress. We need to find a way to value the penny again, to value each insubstantial moment. Because when looking back, it is often the littlest things that we miss most. Life is not usually about the big deal, but that crucial moment. I don't know which penny will matter, but I do know that pennies piled up are still worth something. That's my two cents anyway.
Andrew Hiller is a writer and essayist based in Silver Spring, Maryland. You're tuned to Sidetrack. It's a bird, it's a plane, it's Superman. And in the small southern Illinois town of Metropolis come June 10th, there will be lots of Supermen and Superwomen running through the streets. It's all part of the 32nd annual Superman celebration, where people come from all around to honor the Man of Steel. I recently talked with Angie Shelton, Metropolis's tourism director, about the history of the celebration and what people can expect this year.
Well, Metropolis officially became the hometown of Superman back in 1972, But a renewed interest came about when the first Superman movie with Christopher Reeve was produced, and that's when the first Superman celebration was held. And every year since then, the celebration has been held and has grown to a very huge event for our city of about 6,500 people, but we have between 30,000 and 40,000 people come to Metropolis for 4 days in June for the Superman celebration.
And that's what I was going to ask you. You're a small town there at the tip of Illinois.
Yeah, we're small town Metropolis, not what you would consider a metropolis in the comic book world as far as it being a huge metropolitan area. We're a small town Metropolis, but we do grow to about six times our size during the Superman celebration.
So what events do you have planned for this year?
Well, we have lots of interesting Superman-related activities. One of the most popular is the $1,000 superhero costume contest. We have people that show up in all kinds of costumes, of course, Superman and Supergirl and Wonder Woman. But we've even had people show up as characters from Raiders of the Lost Ark and movies, other movie characters as well. So that's a huge event, and it's really a lot of fun to watch. Even if you don't like to participate, it's just fun to watch. And there are Supergirl, Superboy pageants. There's a Superman road race, a running race, a Super Trek bike ride, a supercar show.
And super weightlifting.
There are weightlifting competitions and exhibitions. We have a strong man who's going to actually be pulling a fire truck this year.
Is he going to be dressed as Superman?
I don't think he'll be dressed as Superman, though.
So what's it like, your town grows six, seven times its normal size, and you have all these people in costumes running around. What's it like?
It's a lot of fun. It's fun for just people watching too. I mean, you see people in spandex that probably shouldn't be in blue spandex, but they're just reliving their childhood and having fun. It's just a very unique atmosphere. It's not like any other really hometown festival anywhere, because it is so unique with seeing people walk around in costumes, and people come from all over the world. We've had people here from Australia and from Japan, and Superman is known the world over, and people that are true fans love to come, and they love to come to small town America. They may be from New York City, but it's such a welcome retreat for them to be in a small town and be able to just park their car on the side of the road and walk up and down the street, and not have to worry about taking a taxi somewhere or a train, or it's just a nice getaway for a lot of people.
And I'm guessing you have people who come back year after year, and after 30 years, you might have generations of people.
We do. We do have people that make it. They plan their family vacation for that time each year, and I'm sure, like you said, there are people that came as a child and now they're coming and bringing their own kids.
So this year you actually have, besides all the other events, you have a special statue unveiling. Tell us
yes.
a little bit about that.
Yes, we are very excited. We are going to be unveiling a slightly larger than life-size bronze statue of Noelle Neal, who is best known for her portrayal as Lois Lane in The Adventures of Superman, along with George Reeves. And she has been a wonderful ambassador of the city of Metropolis. We refer to her as the First Lady of Metropolis. She's been a frequent guest at our Superman celebrations for years, and so a couple of years ago, the decision was made to honor her with the statue. So we have Superman at Superman Square. He's a 15-foot-tall statue, and then two blocks down the street, we will have Lois Lane now, so they can kind of watch over each other from two blocks away.
And she's going to be there, Noelle Neal?
Yes, Noelle is scheduled to be at the unveiling. Like I said, she's been a guest for the last several years at the celebration, and so she's going to be here to pull the cape off of the statue and unveil her, her statue.
And you have other guests as well who are going to be part of this celebration.
We do. We have two celebrities from the Smallville television series. We have Laura Vandervoort, who played Supergirl on Smallville, and Sam Witwer, who played the Doomsday character on Smallville. And the two of them will be here on Saturday during the celebration. And then, of course, Noelle will be here Thursday through Saturday, through Sunday. And we also have the executive producer of Superman 1, 2, and 3, Ilya Salkind. And that's a big event for us to have him here in Metropolis. So all of these people will be accessible to the public at certain times. There will be question and answer sessions at a main tent where you can go and see them in person, and maybe you might get a chance to raise your hand and ask a question. And then we also have autograph sessions where you have to have a ticket to get in.
So are the townsfolk sick of Superman yet? After 30 years, you know, 30 years of guys coming in tights, are they tired of it? What?
Well, no, they're not tired of it. But I think it's probably like any town. You know, if you live in Los Angeles, you probably don't go to Disneyland, you know, because it's there where you are. So people here, I think, may tend to take it for granted a little bit. But there are a lot of people that still get very excited, even living right here, about the celebration and the fun things that happen during that time.
If people want more information about this year's Superman celebration, where should they go?
Well, you can look at a couple of different websites. MetropolisTourism.com has information about the celebration and other attractions in Metropolis. And SupermanCelebration.net is the official site for the celebration. And let me give you a toll-free number for information, and that would be the Metropolis Chamber of Commerce. They're the host of the celebration, and their number is 800-949-5740.
That was Angie Shelton, Tourism Director for Metropolis, Illinois, talking about the upcoming Superman celebration. It runs from June 10th through the 13th. This is Sidetrack. Of course, we all know about Superman's superpowers, faster than a speeding bullet, able to leap tall buildings, etc., etc. If you dig deep enough, everyone has a mundane superpower. It's just a question of finding your inner superhero. Independent producer Matt Larson, based in San Francisco, went out and found all sorts of superheroes walking among us.
So what's your superpower?
I am highly organized, and so when I know where everything is at all times, and if I'm out and about with my backpack on a hike or whatever, you need tissues, you need a Band-Aid, I've got it. I've got it all. You need some bacitracin, I probably have it. You need some gum or knife, I probably have that as well.
So this is like a superhuman, like, utility belt, right? This is like a Batman, like, belt with all your things in it.
Absolutely. I have my utility belt.
My mundane superpower is being able to figure out acronyms.
Does that play out in real life? Can you abbreviate things or what else?
I mean, if somebody gives me, like, a long phrase, I'll abbreviate it, and they'll be like, what?
Superman. Oh, I'll give them one. Okay. So, if you were to shorten the rain in Spain falls mainly on the plain.
TRISFMITP.
My superpower is mentally recording what I pay for everything and how much on sale I get it. Mostly with clothing.
Do you know how much you paid for that outfit?
This outfit? Oh, I mean, I'd have to add it up, but I know that the shoes were 68 from 75, which is not a big deal off. The tank tops were buy one, get one free. The skirt was actually kind of pricey. The skirt was like $100.
So do you have a super weakness, like kryptonite?
Yeah, paying a lot of money for designer things.
My mundane everyday superpower is this weird ability to take small items like a
like a small piece of food or a piece of wadded up paper and to throw it at pretty long distances into a small hole, like a trash can, like a small trash can. I actually find it to be a huge time saver. I'd say that's its biggest use. So like when I'm making lunch at work and I don't want to walk across the room to throw away an avocado pit, I just sit in my chair and I throw it into the trash. It saves me, you know, seconds per day. The one kryptonite I would say for the superpower is actually my wife. When I try to perform this in the company of my wife, I don't seem to be able to do it.
So this is performance anxiety then?
I wouldn't call it that. I would just say I don't know what happens, but she seems to hurt me. I do have one other kryptonite that I've an unrelated kryptonite that I've developed recently, and that is an inability to get jokes. All of a sudden, I've developed this. People start to tell jokes, and all of a sudden, I'm just completely gripped by fear because I don't think I'm going to be able to get the joke, and I'm going to have to laugh awkwardly or explain that I don't get it. So now, when I do this, I immediately, when someone starts to tell a joke, I immediately look over at my wife in fear and hope that she'll at least tell me when to laugh, if not explain what the joke meant.
So she's the kryptonite for throwing things, but for the joke, she might be your. What is it, the red sun of Krypton?
Yeah, she's my red sun for jokes and my kryptonite for throwing small things.
What is your mundane superpower, your everyday talent?
Every girl in front of me is naked.
So can you explain that a little bit?
I just don't seem like they wear clothes.
At all.
At all, in front of me, yeah. Well, I can filter out all the nice-looking girls. All the bad ones just not there at all.
Slightly psychic. I have dreams that predict the future. I had a dream once that I was making love to a tall, strangly Asian man. And I was like, this is really strange. A week later, I met my boyfriend who's very similar to that in appearance.
My superpower is the ability to shake 2 Excedrin out of the bottle on the first try. It's the exact dose. It was actually conferred to me from another who used to possess the skill. He cautioned me that it could fade if I didn't use it often enough, and sure enough, with the years and lack of practice, my skill has deteriorated somewhat.
Whenever I look at a clock in the morning, sometimes at night, I notice that the time is 9:11. I don't think it really has any connection to what happened on 9/11. I mean, I guess I could try to focus on 10/11 or 11:30.
I would like to keep it classy and say urban diction.
Can you give me an example of urban diction? What does that mean?
I guess if some, you know, words that have multiple meanings, like breezy, for instance, is one of my most common or well-publicized terms. It could mean, it could be derogative or as a form of endearment, like, hey, Sarah, breezy, what's poppin'? Or, dang, look at that breezy, what a breezy.
So has this ever come in handy? Like, have you ever used it for good or evil?
At work, definitely. Most people don't know what it means, so I can say it and people don't get offended or they look at me with a big question mark over their head and still give me over 20% tip.
My superpower is that I catch things falling out of the refrigerator and the freezer. The thing about this superpower is that it exercises itself most often in the morning. And if the refrigerator is packed overly full or the freezer is packed overly full and you open the door and things start to fall out, often I find myself almost in this trance-like state, ability to catch everything that falls out. A common example would be getting the coffee grounds out of the freezer in the morning, and as I open the freezer, of course, the peas fall out, and then the ice tray, and then last week's dinner. And as these things are falling out, even in my half-awake stupor, I just find my hands moving into the right spot to catch all these items as they fall out of the freezer. Keep in mind that I can barely even hold a conversation at this time of the morning, but in this circumstance, I seem to have this preternatural ability.
My mundane everyday superpower is winning games of rock, paper, scissors for inane prizes. So once I was dating somebody, and for about 2 years, every morning, we would rock, paper, scissors for who had to make the coffee, and I never made the coffee. I won every time.
So what is your kryptonite?
I would say my kryptonite is when this skill is needed for something that actually matters, I am terrible at it. I have never won any sort of objects of desire with rock, paper, scissors. I always lose.
Well, I discovered in high school, I have the remarkable ability to, when I am watching television, change the station back whenever my TV program comes on. And I can do this with multiple stations. This is something that other people have noticed, and I'm actually kind of proud of. But it proved invaluable for my summers of awkwardness on the couch with just, like, MTV and VH1 as my only friends. It would be, like, MTV Beach House, cut to commercial, and I'd go to, like, the Discovery Channel, see what was going on there. Sometimes there was a commercial over there. You'd pop over to, like, whatever you wanted, you know, VH1, what have you. And I would just, I just know when to turn it back to the beach house. And it would always pick up right exactly when it started. I would cut nothing out.
My superpower is being able to pack a car or a truck very efficiently, no, you know, obvious gaps, and make sure that the stuff you have gets put somewhere. It's basically like a big jigsaw puzzle, except your pieces of the puzzle are stuff. The goal is to find a space for everything, and my biggest weakness is I hate to throw stuff away. If something has a useful life left, I want to make sure that it finds a spot, whether it's in the back of your car or somebody else's home or whatever, which means I accumulate a lot of stuff. And if you saw my garage, you'd know what I was talking about.
If I had to pick a superpower, I think I would say that I have a really phenomenal and almost idiot savant-like ability to remember song lyrics, commercial jingles, anything set to music, preferably from probably like the mid to late 80s. Like if you needed a full transcript of MC Hammer's Stone Cold Rhymin', or any kind of early 90s country, Hey Pretty Lady, Won't You Give Me a Sign, I'd Give Anything to Make You Mine All Mine, like all of those sorts of things, you could really come to me anytime for that. I think my kryptonite would be, there are people that are like, oh man, I'm bad with names, like I'm terrible with names, but I never forget a face. But for me, I have this entire, like all of this brain tissue just totally wrapped up in storing all of these lyrics and jingles that not only do I forget names, I forget faces. And people will come up to me, I'll introduce myself, and they'll say, this is the sixth time we've met, like that sort of thing. Or they'll come up to me and they'll start talking to me. They'll ask about like my parents or some project I've been working on, a trip I was getting ready to take. Like clearly I've had kind of an in-depth conversation with this person in the past. And to my brain, it's like I've never seen them before. My brain is just so busy like curating all of that detailed information that I'm never going to need again about old songs.
That feature from independent producer Matt Larson. Well, that does it for another edition of Sidetrack. Jay Pierce is our senior editor, and I'm your executive producer and host, Jason Croft. Past episodes of Sidetrack are available on our website, and you can subscribe to our podcast as well. Just go to will.illinois.edu/sidetrack. Sidetrack is a production of Illinois Public Media.